Ladies and gentlemen, before going into the subject matter, I would like to say how kind you have been to me by sending me flyers to the hospital. I was put up there in a hallway without my own walls, so the flowers really made it into a palace. It was very wonderful. Thank you very much. Then I have another more difficult and disagreeable task. Some of you have, from their exalted altitude of their wisdom, poked fun at my topic. I had asked you to write on the second Isaiah. It is of course simpler not to write on second Isaiah, but to vituperate that I ask such a question. However, if this gentleman, who doesn't even know how to spell my own name, would have tried to understand second Isaiah, I think he would have made some progress in his immaturity. I think it's a very scandalous paper which I have received. And it's of course the common idiocy of modern students. They don't even know under what conditions a man is allowed to say whether he believes in God or not. You think that is your liberty. This is not a thing of ordering coffee or ordering tea or ordering bread and butter. But to say, here, he writes, I'm in your universal history class, it would not like, instead of working, to make a comment. You put forth the idea that we should be intolerant of other institutional religions. God is not known, he says. He's not understood. He's used. Wonderful. Have you used God? Does God exist? It's like a polish, I suppose. Does God exist? Not God, but life. More than life, a larger, more satisfying life, is, in the last analysis, the end of religion. Now, the impertinence to write in two lines what he thinks religion is, you must realize. Why do you study? Why do you go to higher school of learning if you do not have first the respect for saying that's a very difficult question which probably cannot be answered except by my whole life, the whole devotion of all my actions in life, my marriage, the way I educate my children, the way I go to war, the way I sacrifice my money for the poor. This would be a way of implementing religion, the word term, the mere word religion. This young man has not the faintest idea, and so I have written down, read more good poetry. Your text is simple nonsense. And I, of course, that's not the only text of this kind. May I leave this with you for the rest of your lives, gentlemen? I will not see you again. I will have passed away, and it isn't important. But it is very important that you should never interfere with a respectable debate on the existence of God and on his character. And the first condition for this is that you must know of God we only speak in earnest when we are forced, compelled to name him. This is not something you can do like you play cards. This is not something as you write a letter to the editor. This is a very serious business, very disagreeable when you are in love, desperately in love, and you suddenly have to admit that this love is stronger than any of your reasons not to go for this girl. Then you begin to fathom for the first time what a God is. It's an overwhelming power. It's nothing to discuss. It's incredible that you could be 20 years and come to such a wonderful place as this here and haven't even learned the ABC, which every 14-year-old boy was supposed to know 100 years ago. That God is that power which compels you to kneel down and fall prostrate. That's the only power that deserves the term the divinity. Do you think that's a concept? It's an idea or all such nonsense? I really felt that my whole course had come to naught when I read this paper. This is not cowbells, the discussion of the divine. I know that you are all atheists, but then say so. And see, I have no reason to believe in God because he hasn't made me kneel down. That's all right. It's very poor. You have a very poor soul then, because there is no such man who has not in some emergency felt that he must pray. All this is not the question of debate, all this is not the question of philosophy, not a question of psychology, not a question of analysis, not a question of economics. Don't believe it. It's a power that rules your life. And woe to you if you have no such powers which rule your life. If you haven't, begin to weep. You are then hopelessly left by all good spirits. Now, I had to say that much, and let's forget about it. This boy is just an idiot. And you must learn to despise such utterances as utter nonsense. They are well valueless. Of course, if there is no power in your life, why do you talk about it? Nobody has to discuss religion. It's not a painting, it's not a concept, it's not an article in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's nothing of the kind. It is your weakness. And that weakness can either come from God or from the devil. Usually it comes from the devil. But nobody should write such utter nonsense at the age of 20. I think that religion, he has written, should be a function of man's own self-interest. I think more stupidity has never been rained down on the University of California. But this, you can get away with this today. People are so vain and so stupid that I think one half of you wouldn't think anything if I read this sentence to you without my exclamation mark. You would think that's a normal attempt to define God. Now, God cannot be defined. God is an explosion which is stronger than you. It's very disagreeable to believe in God. It changes everything. All your notions, all your concepts, all your philosophies, all your reasons, they all go. When there's one power in your life, well, you just have to go to the girl. You shouldn't, but you do. And then you will begin to know that there are powers in your life that are much stronger than you yourself. And then you begin to fathom what is meant by the term God, and not before. So please take this down as a note in my book, otherwise I can't go to heaven and can't die quietly, you see, that God is not a concept. It is only, you have only the compulsion to speak of God when you have experienced him as an immense power. You would like to steal, but you can't. You would like to elope with a girl, but you can't. You would like to desert the army, but you can't. Then that's the beginning of some experience. Now, I have a more agreeable problem. I have written a book, or many books, but this is here now available in the Torch edition. And we have ordered 20 volumes, and I'm quite willing to part with them after they must be read, even if you don't pay for them. So I'm willing to give them away, but I must find a method of distributing these 20, either to the most undeserving or to the most deserving. So will you kindly think up a method of getting rid of them? I can throw them out here, but I don't think that's fair. And I just have no method. I don't have 150 copies, but there are 20. So will somebody at the half, I will make a break after in half an hour, and somebody perhaps come forward with a proposition how to get rid of them. I don't want to carry them home. There they are. Well, here's my doctor. She gets the copy. We have two more meetings, and both meetings are appropriately, I think, devoted to one millennium of the Christian era. We have coped with the first 1,000 years, and we have labeled them the 1,000 years of all saints. And I have tried to tell you that beginning with Christ himself and the 12 apostles and the evangelists, the saints filled the Christian calendar until in 1854, so many had entered the roster that the church declared that they needed a general day, all saints, at which day all the martyrs and confessors and virgins and otherwise saints could be remembered, even if they had not a day of their own. And to this day, the church in the East, as much as in the West, in Russia, as much as in Greece or Constantinople, as in San Francisco, celebrates November 1st, and the eve of it, Halloween. And you celebrate it too. You only celebrate the eve, not the saint day itself. And so your pumpkin Christianity is still discoverable in rudiments in your Halloween celebration. Now these saints have unified the world. And on this I would like to say one more word, because I have found your complete ignorance about the separation of East and West within the Christian Church and how it came about. When in 1854 the Day of All Saints was established, the Church in the East, in the eastern half of the Mediterranean and in the western half of the Mediterranean, were undivided. They were not separated. There was no schism. The Greek word for the split is schism. Schizon means to split. A hair splitter would be a schizon. And therefore, if you hear today of Christianity, you will rarely hear anything about with regard to the Greeks, but at least in San Francisco we have a Greek church, a Greek Orthodox church still in action, and the patriarch of the American Orthodox Church is not in obedience of the papacy in Rome. This much you may know. It is quite interesting to know how this came about. It came about on the very day of All Saints in 864. Well, no, I'm not sure now. Does anybody? It's either 864 or 854. The Carolingian emperors, Charlemagne especially, himself and his son and grandson, were very anxious to establish their dignity as emperors of the West. And therefore they looked for any possibility of hitting hard, slapping the face of the Eastern emperor. The Pope in Rome had so far been always in obedience or in harmony with the Eastern emperor. It was a novelty that there should be an emperor in the West again of Frankish descent, non-Roman, non-Byzantine, non-Greek descent. And that has brought on something that plagues us to this day, the so-called schism, in the following way. And I think if you listen to me for this rather complicated little story, you will see how intricate human history really takes its course. The emperor of the West, Charlemagne in Aix-la-Chapelle, tried to find fault with the Byzantine emperor, and therefore he had to prove that this was not an orthodox man. If you could prove at that time that somebody was not orthodox, he couldn't be emperor. So he tried to make his bishops excommunicate the bishop of the emperor of the East, and so they debated the problem whether the spirit proceeds from the Father through the Son to us people, or from the Father into the Son. And as you may know, in the Western world to this day, with Protestants as well as Catholics, the dogma runs that the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Now, the facts are very simple, that the theologians have had discussed this for 300 years without coming to any decision, they said, you can say it's, he proceeds from the Father and the Son, or from the Father through the Son. The important thing is, you see, that Christ is in history. That is not, he is not an idea, as my our friend believed, whom I have quoted today, that that God was just a book, a word, but he proceeds, that is, he shows his power to grip us and to lead us to action. And this is not a minor matter, of course, whether we say that the Spirit enters history not by abstract philosophizing, but by getting people to take arms and to march and to marry and to migrate and to come to the United States, proceeds meaning action, power to be involved, to be compelled to do things. This is the only interesting thing, after all. You cannot wonder that the Holy Spirit, who is a form of God himself, can only prove himself by real appearance, by real influencing people. So the discussion was a very good scholastic discussion in Aix-la-Chapelle and in Paris and several other places, even Canterbury, where they usually do not have any mind whatsoever. But you see, we have the English for non-thinking. And this is what happened. The Charlemagne was an impatient gentleman, and he compelled the bishops of the Frankish Empire, which embraced, comprehended Spain and France and Germany and England too, and Denmark and Italy, so quite a big piece of the cake. He forced them to put this officially in the creed so that every Sunday it came from the pulpit. You see, I believe in the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, who proceeds from the Father and the Son. The Pope hadn't made up his mind to put this into the creed at that time. He had no objection to the sentence, but he said, you cannot force the Easterners to do this too before we have talked to them, before there has been a synod. Now, mostly there was war and there were no synods, and therefore the East had not received this new news message of the death of God theologians. And you see, the theologians have always had such funny ideas as they have today. Mr. Harvey Cox and the fathers of the church in the 9th century had the same kind of problems. How to keep God alive. And they hoped, of course, if they said, who proceeds from the Father and the Son, that this would impress people with his majesty. For 50 years did the papacy in Rome and the Frankish bishops quarrel. Should it be put in the creed or should it not? Finally, the Pope was very angry and had plates cut out from marble and ore. I don't know what mineral it was, probably copper plates, in which he omitted the from the Son. Filioque is the Latin word for this, and the Son, you see, who proceeds from the Son, and protested that his orthodox old creed did not contain this. In the meantime, in Aix-la-Chapelle, and wherever the victorious generals of the Franks marched in, they preserved, you see, drummed it into everybody's ears, which who proceeds from the Father and the Son. So there was a divergence in the style of the liturgy. And at that time, and that's why I think the whole story deserves to be told, the great decisions of mankind have been made in and by the liturgy. There was stated what was to be true. Today you have statistics instead. I don't know whether it is any better. Anybody, any time has generalities, any time has general rules. Now, we govern, if you look at the United Nations, they try to prove everything by statistics. But not one word is true. Statistics never are true, you see. The statistics are only true for the one who made them. And nobody else can understand them. And it's similar, of course, with filioque. And the result was that by 854, the popes weakened. Although in the front of the Vatican in Rome, there was this copper plate without the filioque, they allowed this new form of the Frankish clergy to be said. And 200 years later, the Byzantines said, you have changed the creed. We are no longer in obedience with Rome, in harmony with Rome, without asking us, without love, that is, without brotherly love, you have proceeded to insert into the creed these two words, fil jocque. We had a right to be asked, we never agreed. Now, and imagine, from this day on, 1054, the whole Eastern world has lived in schism with the West. Small causes and great effects. The fact that the secular branch, the secular arm of government, the empire, dared to change the liturgy, as Charlemagne had positively done, has brought about the fact that to this day the Patriarch in San Francisco cannot go to the same service as a Catholic bishop. And that's the only reason. There's no distinction otherwise. The strange thing is, that's why it is worth your noting, you see, that in history, as in families, the lovelessness, the lack of charity between the Pope and the Patriarch is more important and has more damage than anything intellectual. There is no debate, there was never a debate, a real discussion of the merit of this formula. The Patriarch in the East to this day says, we have not been asked. Therefore, you have broken the faith. The Western said, no, don't be angry. The Charlemagne is a very powerful gentleman. He had more generals than you. And I better give in. He marched into Rome. And it isn't so important. After all, what difference does it make? Two words, fil jocque. Why don't you accept them and overlook this? Byzantine to this day stand pat and say, we don't overlook that you have broken the tie of charity. It doesn't matter whether this is true or not, the way it has been put into the Western creed is intolerable. Now, if you would note this down for your private life, it may save you a divorce. That in life, the lack of charity is much more disastrous and important than the lack of intelligence. It is not important that everybody should understand everything else, but it is very important that he should be required to agree. And there, that's why the story of the schism in this little niche of the church history in the 9th century is of much greater value for your political education than all the editors of McCabe and Tecabe and how all these gentlemen call themselves who flood you with editorials. This is a true story. And on this, the future of mankind depends. And I wonder what will happen, when it will be put away. Of course, there are now people in the church who even understand this, that they are so touchy. I have a Roman Catholic friend who is sitting here in this hall who has suffered because his teacher could not forgive me that I had pointed this out, that this was so. He was a good Orthodox Roman Catholic. Roman Catholic cannot do any wrong in regard to ecclesiastical affairs. Therefore, his boss did not allow him to think so. So it's a very practical question. It is not valueless. You think this, for the last 100 years, people have been inclined to call this quibbling and to say that theological dogmatic discussions are fruitless. I've never found it so. The more you go look into the discussions of the fathers of the church, or Luther, or whomever, or Wesley, the more you find that they were really concerned with important questions. The only unimportant question is the question of taxation, which you take to be very serious. And it is very strange. It is not possible to draw attention to the central importance of these ultimate statements of our existence on this earth. They are very important. So I have a very old-fashioned, and today most books begin with statements that, of course, the period of religious wars is over and religious quibbles, and now we only debate the degree of vitamins. I don't believe that you can live in peace if you do not agree on the important questions of life. We are only human beings if we are held together by unified convictions. And you are quite erroneous. The margin of error, which is tolerable for having 2 billion people live at peace on this globe, this margin of error is very narrow. And if you try to begin all the heresies of the world, polygamy and slavery and what have you, and say, what does it matter? I have just this private opinion, you have this private opinion. Would be nice to have a nice slave. It can't be done, you see. The word slave has to be rejected from the vocabulary. John Smith has to be deposed in Rhodesia. And that's not a minor matter. Why that is so? Because, obviously, we were created in the image of God, because that's the only way in which all human beings can agree on anything. As soon as you allow these profound distinctions to go unheeded and unrespected, you are at war. We had this with Hitler. As soon as a Jew is not a human being, out he goes. He's burned at stake. He's gassed. It's very serious. Gentlemen, you live in a period, the next 50 years will show it, in which there is no mercy between human beings. That has been introduced into the world. There was no mercy between Jews and Germans in Germany. Consequence, there's ultimate war, annihilation, and nothing else. First, you must be sure that these swines, that they will let you live before you can go into this country and settle there and buy property and write a book. And allow your son to marry such a man's daughter? That's very serious. And I find that people laugh this off and say it's all over. Well, Hitler, that's all gone. It's only 20 years ago. There's no time. 20 years? Don't figure in history. After 150 years, I will begin to talk with you about an event, you see, but not before. It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't been followed up to its consequences. But you live already, you see, always the next day after the editorial. And you think the editorial finishes the event. It doesn't. It's just the beginning, the first understanding of the event. 150 years later, we will know what Mr. Hitler did to the future of the Jews and the Christians in Europe and in America. We don't know yet. And this can be studied in the 3 articles of our faith. The creed of the first 1,000 years summed up very neatly the amount of freedom that every confessor of this creed requires, demands, expostulates, and wants to see ascertained to himself, his children, his family, his government, and what have you. And therefore, don't believe that you, when you live in the year 1967, could live without the year 864. This is with us. The proposition being that we have inherited these great truths. That you still can claim that because you are a child of God, you are created in the image of God. And you have an unbreakable right to live out your mind, your spirit, your physique, even your love and affection. You can even marry whom you want to marry. Do you think that is understandable to men in Asia or in India, for example, where they live by caste, and where a man who is a member of another caste is not a human being, it's just an animal? See, Hindus do not know the brotherhood of men. Don't believe this for a minute. They have never heard of it. They deny it. They can see a man die next and around the corner and see what's that to me. It's not a human being. I am a Brahmin, but he isn't. Well, I think there are people in Woodside who think the same. You don't know how frail the fundamental insides of the human race are. And that's why I had to chastise this gentleman who didn't know my name, that knew all about God. Yeah. It is so very little that is needed, but that is exacting. You can't go behind it. Once you deny that the Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, anything is possible. And as you see in California, it seems that anything is possible. Remember the men from Cupertino, you see, and the men who cut off the ear, the soldier, the marine. We live in the midst of a repaganization of the world of the largest scale, and the fastest progress is made in the United States. Because there's no resistance. We have no established church, we have no tradition, we have superintendent of schools, and therefore football is everything. It's all sports, it's all records. In records, gentlemen and ladies, nothing is limited. Records you can have for obscenity, records you can have for illegitimate children, records you can have for beer. Record is just figure, is without any qualification. And I see with great, really great fear, this victory today of figures, statistics. Because statistics have no quality, they lie all the time, you see. And I can recommend you one way out, see. Whenever something is proven to you by quantity, everybody does, you see. Then you must remember that I once was comforted by a student of mine. He came to the house and he was working on Madison Avenue with statistics. And I said, but this isn't so, this is terrible. He said, you are statistically unimportant. Now, a man can go to heaven only today if he agrees that he is statistically unimportant. And even women can only, you see. You must say to your every morning and evening, it's the best prayer. Thank God I am statistically unimportant. Now, my task now is to put before you in a lump the achievement of the 1,000 years between 854 and 1889. I take this not at random. This year, 1889, is a very peculiar year. Of course, I can't tell you the story of the 1,000 years, and it would even be against your interest to get this whole story told, because the amazing fact is that it's a short story, that it can be said in one lecture, and that these 1,000 years have a common content and have a common goal. In order to do this, you may say, I have to curtail things, I have to abbreviate things, I have to lump them together, of course. However, the truth will not be violated in this manner at all. The story is short, is condensed, and there's one topic. In 1889, the President of the United States, who wasn't then the President, but was the man who deserved to become it, Woodrow Wilson, wrote a book on the state in which he proved to his satisfaction, it was one of the reasons which enabled him to become President of the United States later and to found the League of Nations, in which he said the many states, the many governments on this globe are now so close to each other and share so many activities. Think of the mail, think of medicine, think of traffic, think of trade, that they have to get together and have to be united. It is impossible to sustain the notion of sovereign states. You know that this inside of Mr. Woodrow Wilson hasn't even conquered now. Not even now does our government agree to that. And you wouldn't probably, and certainly the people as I know them in California don't agree to this. They want more sovereignty if they can. However, a wise man like Wilson banked on this and said the day of the individual separate state is over. So there is a history of 1,000 years, 854 to 1889, at whose end the best political sciences of his day says this story must be crossed out. It's finished. The world has to become one in some form or other. In other words, we no longer can go to war against each other, which any reasonable person knows, but about which nobody does anything. I grew up at a time of the twilight of the gods, between 1889, when Woodrow Wilson's book already had been published, and 1914, you couldn't get the electorate on any such platform. Woodrow Wilson couldn't have been elected president on the platform of his book, you see. So the tragedy of thought is that we all live on two or three wavelengths. You may be in your mind much advanced, and in your politics you still have to stick to slogans, you see, which you have to repeat over and over again. When Franklin D. Roosevelt ran for president for the third time in 1940, he was asked to go to Boston and to ensure the Irish mothers once more that no Irish child would be exposed to the dangers of warfare. Of course, he knew that 6 days after he would be re-elected, he would be to go to war against Hitler. Everybody knew it. Only the press and the electorate were not allowed to know it. And the poor man then said that in despair to his advisors, "Must I really tell these big lies?" "Yes," he said, "in Boston you must." So he went to Boston obediently and said it. And of course it had no influence whatsoever, but it was the prayer mill that you at that time had to say. And this country is full of such prayer mills, as you know, that have to be said. They have no meaning, they are obsolete totally, but if the electorate doesn't hear them, you can't be elected. This is a great, of course, that is the ruin of democracy in the long run. If this goes on too long, either the country is destroyed because of these big lies, you see, or words have lost their meaning. And this is, at this moment, the state of democracy in this country. We suffer from it in Vietnam. The government doesn't tell us anything that anybody can understand. Life is always much more serious when it comes to speech, and it reminds me of this wonderful document here of this man who doesn't know my name. On God, you see, that it is, what did he say? "I think the religion should be a function of men's own self-interest." Something more stupid you really cannot think of. And that's what the Irish in Boston also said, that was, you see, religion was something in their self-interest. The content of these 1,000 years, from 854 and to 1889, can be defined, and you all know it. Every part of the globe has had an opportunity of speaking up and making its own contribution. If you think of Italy, France, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Spain, Sweden, with Selma Lagerlöf, for example, you can only admire the abundance with which voices of the human orchestra have begun to resound, so that you and I, we know of brothers who speak in a different language and yet are needed to our own edification. I don't think that a child should grow up without the fairy tales of Selma Lagerlöf. You certainly shouldn't grow up without the dramas from Shakespeare, and on it goes, and the novels of Balzac. That is, you take it for granted that we live in a concert hall of many national voices. These national voices did not exist in 854. All saints spoke the common language of the church liturgy, of the communion supper, but they did not look back on national creations of a national literature. You take this today for granted. It is on the way out. I don't think we will have such a national literature any longer in the future. I'm very pessimistic about that. I don't see any signs that there is even the possibility of such productions because the nations have no longer this warmth and this interest towards themselves. The man in Paris doesn't look any longer only to Montmartre and to the Pont des Arts, but he may, just like Exupery, go to Brazil. Well, once Mr. Exupery, you know, what's his first name? Saint-Exupery. If he lives long enough in Brazil, he doesn't contribute to the French literature. That's impossible. And that's what you see happening, you see. Imagine all the contributions I could have made to German literature. Now I'm here. But that's very serious because it hits everybody. And therefore, this time of national literature is gone except for the departments of literature. And it must go. We can't afford these watertight compartments. Now, for 1,000 years, from 854 exactly to 1889, the nations of the world, the civilized nations, the Christian nations, however you call them, ensouled all the members of their communities with a tremendous enthusiasm and with a spirit which exalted these people, not to saints, but ensouled them. And the symbol of this day, of this life of the nations, is the holiday of All Souls. And that's a very strange story how that came about. I told you that All Saints was established in 854 by the Pope, and still in togetherness with the Greek Church, before the schism. And for that reason, the saints are remembered all over the Christian Church. With souls, it is very different. In the year 1000, there was a pious abbot, and I think he deserves to be mentioned as the founder of Europe and the founder of the Western world. His name was Odilo, which means a man of nobility. And he was the abbot of a monastery situated in a place similar to Chicago in Europe, in the midst of the Rhone, the Seine, and the Rhine Valley. Cluny. The Clunyac monks, you may have heard the name, they are quite, have still a little reputation. The important thing about this abbot, however, was that he took pity on all the unredeemed, on all the people who had not gone to grammar school and not gone to church, who had been not baptized, who were pagans to the Gentile world. And he said, they are my ancestors. They are our brothers and sisters. Where are they? They have lived before us. We cannot deny them. In addition to all saints who are now glorifying the Lord's name by their victories in mission, in the field of missions, by Christianizing the world, we must now show our love to those unconverted masses, noblemen, chieftains, hunters, what have you, sailors. And he instituted for their salvation the day after All Saints, which to this day in the calendar is entitled All Souls. He went into trouble with this, and this trouble I think I should tell you of, because it shows you how difficult it is, the slightest progress in the history of mankind in the respect to his soul is. The popes in Rome said, you can't do this. You can't make the 2nd of November in the Day of All Souls, because All Saints is a big holiday, and a big holiday in the Christian Church consists of an eve and 2 days. You see, this is so hard for any man who comes from Europe to understand that you don't believe that Christmas is 2 holidays, and Easter is 2 holidays, and Pentecost is 2 holidays. With us, the Monday is as much the holiday of Easter Sunday, you see, as Easter Sunday itself. And You swindle now, you know. You have always now, when the holiday is on a Sunday, you add the Monday. But that's just a return to sanity, because you can't have a high holiday out of consisting of 24 hours. That's an error of judgment. And the word day, you are such superstitious people that the very word day is misleading you. A day must be 24 hours. Who says this? If you are divine as you are, your holiday must always be at least 48 hours. The rest is nonsense. The error in America is that you think because something is called a day, it lasts 24 hours. That is, I call superstition. But you call me superstitious. So we call, scold each other. But this debate has really taken place over hundreds of years between the people who believe in the holiday of the soul, which of course must express itself in a true holiday of infinite length, and the geometricians and these terrible arithmeticians who count 24 hours and say that's one day. But it can't be a holiday. A holiday is outside the clockwork of the precision mechanism. The Jewish week, of course, has this same example where the holidays on New Year are 2 days also. Well, what happened in 998, 130 years after the establishment of all saints, was that this abbot of Cluny became very popular with the masses in Europe, and they all followed his proposition to set one day aside, the 2nd of November, for the memory of all the unchristianized, unbaptized heathen, and decided to pray them free for heaven and to celebrate their memory, and said they did something good too. Yes, they were not baptized, they were not cardinals and bishops, and they were not even confirmed, but they were our ancestors, and they are mankind. And therefore, they have to receive some rank, some standing in the community. And they did. And this debate between Rome and Cluny has lasted 800 years. For 800 years, Cluny said, November 2nd is a special holiday for the non-Christian souls. And the Pope in Rome said, I'm sorry, you can't celebrate this because there have to be 3 masses said on a high holiday, like All Saints, and this takes 2-3 days, an eve and 2 days, and therefore, since the mass has to be said on November 2nd, still in memory of All Saints, All Souls is not a Roman holiday. And this has lasted to the end of the 19th century. For 1,000 years then, the cleavage between the monastic tradition of praying for the Gentiles, praying for the unconverted, praying for the, so to speak, the earlier, the pristine world, you see, and this triumph over the deeds of the saints who had already accomplished great things in the field of missions, has lasted. I think this is the best way for me to teach you history. This cleavage is the content of a whole 1,000 years. That there was this cleft, that the people did not agree, that's the grandeur of the story. Because there were 2 powers at work. One who said we must get all the nobility out of the Gallic spirit, out of the Italian spirit, out of the Swedish spirit, out of the Finnish spirit, Danish, what have you. All the nations must become vocal with their unified, with their coherent, cooperative efforts, I should say. And the Christian message, which says the individual perfect soul, the peace of the individual person must be stressed. A saint is a man who can show his perfection as a creature of God, single. And a soul is somebody who is within a group and is there the ferment, thanks to which the group as such is humanized and is alive. This has lasted 1,000 years. So I always think that this would be a good way of teaching history for finding the conflicts that have had to be kept burning, have to be kept searing people, because that the Cluniac monks and the bishops and cardinals in Rome could not agree on the treatment of this new holiday. It's just a wonderful story. It wouldn't have been good if they had agreed, because both parties now got going. Both parties tried to prove their point. And in this competition, of course, we get the French and the English and the Italian and the German's character beautifully unfolded. All the great deeds of the nations of the last 1,000 years are the fruits of this German nation, of this seed of all souls. What is a soul? A soul is only a living part of a whole body politic, of a whole human carrier. A saint is somebody who is able to stand alone, to be understood by you and admired for his singleness, in his personality, as we call it today, which is a very poor word. Whenever you try to use the word personality, you get a hiccup. So that's why I felt I should do this today, put the Day of All Souls as a title page, on the title page of a whole 1,000 years. The protest of the laity, represented by this monk of Cluny, Odilo, against a purely clerical, purely sacramental view of history, both has borne fruit. If you today have these national characters, I've written this whole volume here on the European revolutions, on the way in which, under the influence of the Day of All Souls, the English, the Italians, the French, the Russians have made their way into the world, so that you today know very well what to expect from a member of these nations as their great contribution to civilization. You know that in Paris, there's something to be had for everybody. And you know that this is true of London and Oxford. And you know that this is true of Rome and Florence. And it is even true of Heidelberg and Madrid. You are inclined to forget these things today and not even to hear them. The terrible way of teaching history today is that it is only secular. They only tell you, I mean, the number of copies sold by Shakespeare in the people's library. The story is much more complicated. Before these nations could write Shakespeare's plays, they had also to write Chaucer. And they had also to write many religious poetry. The life of these nations is infinitely richer than in your plan today of studies is ever admitted. We have today a dried out vision of mankind. You look at quantities and how many plays acted. It isn't this, it is the unfolding of a tremendous family conversation through the ages, gentlemen. And that's so interesting and so exciting, and it's so incredibly rich and varied. Who has still read Tolstoy's War and Peace? Please. Well, that is not bad. Thank you. But it is a very small proportion. You couldn't live 100 years ago, although Russia had served them. So Russia was far away, nobody had gone to Russia in person. They had no electric light. They had not even water toilets. But they had the greatest poetry of the 19th century. War and Peace is a book that is, there's nothing in Europe to match it. Now that's a miracle. Here was a Greek Catholic country, even through the schisma, separated, you see, religiously from the East Western world. And there was a country with slaves just as bad as Mississippi. And the greatest poem of Europe was composed in 1861 by Leo Tolstoy in Russia. Whether you like it or not, or whether you take notice of it, you won't change the fact that it was the greatest poem and remains the greatest poem. And of course it has disappeared from the American curriculum by a kind of aping of the Russian Bolsheviks now, because the Bolsheviks can't make too much of a book written by a count, Tolstoy, you see. So I understand now that in your Western civilization, it is not included. Terrible. The funny thing in America is your eagerness to fall for the stupidity of Russian present-day literature. Gentlemen, there is a wonderful literature in Russia, only it is pre-Bolshevik. And the Bolshevik literature is no literature. It's statistics. And it's very funny. All America is sick with this idea that you must learn what these damned Russians write today. It's not worth reading. It's on water toilets. Very strange, you see. A completely wrong surrender to the Russians. You must love the Russians, of course, but for what they are great for, and not for this idiocy of Mr. Karl Marx. That's not a Russian. He lived in England, you see, and that's why everything he has written is so boring. So things are a little more complicated than you think. The blossoming, the blooming, the coming into fruit, seed and fruit of the various nations of Europe is the miraculous story of the last 1,000 years. I am not sorry that I have not the time to go into the details. As I said, I have written this volume, and that's now in its fourth edition. It's called The European Revolutions. And you can read it. The English title is Outer Revolution, Autobiography of Western Man. I mention this only to say it isn't laziness that I do not go into the details of the story, but it seems to me necessary at this moment to stress the fact that there was a common enterprise, a common undertaking, a unified action over 1,000 years. Your belief in history is so totally shaken, so totally destroyed. You believe so much in the events of the day, which are no events. It's not an event that some horse runs over some other horse. One is called man and the other is called horse. What's the difference? You have an accident history nowadays, consisting of innumerable facts, you see. This is not history. History is only there where men takes a new lease on life. And in these last 1,000 years, under the influence of all souls, you and I have been invited, if we cannot become independent saints, personalities like Saint Augustine, to cooperate in a group and be ensouled inside this group. Like a good orchestra, like a good theatrical group. You all do this now when you practice here for a play. You know that the individual is not the soul alone. It's an ensoulment. You participate in a process thanks to which you breathe inside a harmonious whole. And the word soul cannot be abandoned. When I was young, it was the fashion, and it's now the fashion in this country, to say souls. William James used to say, I don't know who they are. Now, he was the most ensouled man of them all, but he had the audacity to say that he didn't know whether they were souls. And all our psychologists deny the human soul. But you will know very well that if a troop of actors plays together well, there is a common spirit, and they are ensouled, and not one of them is the soul, the oversoul, at all. But everybody receives from this rhythm of the whole some element of life without which he would be all the poorer. You couldn't recognize him if he hadn't been inflated and blown up and suggested, so to speak, the activities which stem from this cooperative fellowship. It is not just the troupe on the stage, but here in this classroom, we couldn't sit together at peace if there was not a common spirit at this moment. It's not my soul, it's not your soul, there's no oversoul, you see, but it is ensouled. And any good classroom has this, any good family room has this. Yet we live in a moment, at a moment where these bastards decline to admit that man has a soul. This is really some achievement. And every little, smallest endeavor here be it in the office of the president, of the chancellor, of the provost, or on your own, depends on this ensorment, that people understand each other, open up to each other, expect from each other to be helped along and to be assisted. We take it so much for granted that nobody seems to care what this is. Well, it is here, thanks to the Day of All Souls, as it has encouraged you and me for the last 1,000 years, and I hope will still encourage us a little longer. That's why I don't think it is necessary for me now to unfold the story of these various nations, but to insist that the Day of All Souls has been operative from 854 to 1889, to the moment in which the man, the future president of the United States, said, it's all over. It's too tight now. It's all there. We have to do something in a new range, you know, a new unity. Automatically, these nations are so powerful now and so independent and so sovereign, you see, if there's a misunderstanding, they'll destroy each other. And lo and behold, 25 years later, they did destroy each other. And don't forget, take this, write this down, because nobody wants to know it today. There has never been made peace since 1914. We live at war since 1914 in this Western world of ours. Think of what this means. It's all swindle when you are told that there has been made peace. Never has there been made peace. The United States, as you know, went home without the League. When Wilson went home, he gathered the students of this country at his bedside, paralyzed as he was, and a dying man in January 23, and he said, since peace has not been made, I warn you that the Second World War must come much more horrible than the first. This was said in 1923, but of course, the boulevard papers and the great shots, Time and Life, they didn't have to care. So they could have the illusions, and you have the illusion today that there is peace. Do you think Germany and the United States are at peace? They are not. That we are in Vietnam at war is a salvation, because at least it reminds you of the reality. You live in a fiction. There is no peace at this moment. Never has there been made peace since 1914. And if you think, would ponder over this, you would be surprised that we still breathe, that we still eat, that we still even teach. This is a war situation. All the rest is bunk. And that of course shows in your treatment of Vietnam. You take it out on the Vietnamese, your own bad conscience that you haven't made peace in Europe. We are riddled with war. But nobody is allowed to say these things. It's too disagreeable, you see. You prefer to deal with Mr. Powell and Mr. Dodd. The ensoulment of the mankind is at a standstill at this moment, because the old functions, when peace was made in war treaties and so, and genuine sponsorship is gone. I mean, look at this behavior of Mr. de Gaulle with the English. They just don't talk to each other anything honest anymore. Well, I could go on forever. The important thing is, however, the fact that a whole 1,000 years of all souls have ceased to function. Next time I propose to put before you the fact that this was felt deeply in 1889. It's a strange year. Everything has come together in this year. It is never mentioned by the learned, and it is the most important year in the history of the last 1,000 years. Why? The Day of All Souls ceased to function. Somebody exclaimed at that time, God is dead. You hear today as an echo, Mr. Harvey Cook, the death of God, the theologians, they only always come 18 years later. And that's what they say now. But it was said then, and it was effective then, for many reasons. I could prove this to you. And a new cry began, by the way, starting in America, just as Woodrow Wilson was the first swallow, the first men knowing that the day of the sovereign state had vanished. So the workers of America came to Europe in 1889, unknown to you, and said, we need an international holiday for the working man, because our body is enslaved and served everywhere in the globe. The globe is one. Mechanics, coal mining, steam, electricity, that's all international, that's worldwide. All this is nonsense. There is no American economy, there is no German economy, there is no French economy. And you wouldn't believe it, but it were Americans who invented at that time May Day, which is now the international payday, as you know, holiday of the Russian Revolution. Before there was any Labor Day in the United States, there was May Day as an American invention. I think it's very important for you to understand that long before there was a rift between communism and socialism and liberalism in the world, there was unity. It were American working men who proposed May 1st, which is now the great Russian communist holiday. They came to Paris in the year of the Lord, 1889, and begged their French colleagues and their German colleagues to celebrate May 1st. I think that's quite a story, because it shows you that what is happening since 1889, this lack of peace, this breakdown of sovereignty, and this getting together on our physical needs is a very important central story already for nearly 100 years. Only you and my mind is so slow, of course, you cannot understand anything that really happens unless it has lasted 100 years. Jesus Christ, Christianity was not visible before the end of the first century to the Romans. And the same way it is true today that the physical unity of the universe will have to be celebrated in the future, but it's already around us, it's already with us. So I have saved up the problems of Labor Day, the problem of May Day, the problem of our physical unity on this globe for the last meeting.